The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back to the show. We're going to continue our conversation about big tech and big tech censorship that we began with Roger Kimball before the break, specifically talking about Shelby and Eli Steele, his son's new film, What Killed Michael Brown, being essentially delisted by Amazon Prime. It's not being accepted for streaming at Amazon.Prime after the impression was for months, as the documentary was being produced, that it would be. I mean, Shelby Steele, again, one of the great cultural, the intellects on culture and race relations of the last 50 years in this country, dating back to the civil rights movement in the 60s, like many conservative black Americans who the left does and the big tech part of the left does their best to try to silence. So here we are again. This combined with, of course, the bigger story politically because of the election, this New York Post story about Hunter Biden emails from a computer that was turned over to a Delaware store and then turned over to Rudy Giuliani, it would appear, that contain what appear, pending authentication, to be emails that suggest that Joe Biden was not telling the truth when he said he had no involvement with his son Hunter's business dealings. And point of fact, Hunter Biden, according to an email, orchestrating a meeting between Joe Biden and this executive at Burisma, where he was on the board at the time, back in 2017. Yesterday, John Paul Mac Isaac, the owner of the computer store in question, gave sort of a rambling, difficult to follow interview to press about the particulars of how he came upon this computer at his repair shop, who dropped it off, his contact with or not with the FBI, and what direction that contact occurred. Same thing with Rudy Giuliani. I don't know that it was helpful of much, and it certainly wasn't conclusive in terms of authentication. But nonetheless, the larger question is Facebook and Twitter putting the halt on the dissemination of this New York Post story. Also suspending the account, as we spoke with earlier in the show with Mark Lauder from the Trump campaign, suspending the account of Kayleigh McEnany for posting the Post story. It seems like the question that our friend Khalid Lataro raises in his most recent piece at Real Clear Politics is social media more harmful than helpful to our representative republic? Is one to revisit yet again. Khalid Lataro is a Real Clear Media Fellow, Senior Fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. Khalid, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me again.
It seems like we continue rapidly along the same trajectory we've been on. No amount of documentaries, no amount of whistleblowers, no amount of curious terminations, no amount of even more curious suspensions can stop big tech from deciding what content is acceptable in discourse and what content is not. And they're happily willing to marginalize those whose views they find objectionable.
What's amazing here is that there's been kind of this building of big tech slowly ramping up its kind of censorship. And then this year has really been a watershed. You've sort of seen them, you know, before they were very cautious. You know, they would do something and kind of see how everyone reacted and then take these baby steps. This year, it's sort of like they don't care anymore. They're just content to do anything that they want. What's interesting is you have the mainstream media really cheering them on and saying, this is great. You know, last week, for the first time ever, actually halted Donald Trump from being able to tweet. It's one thing to flag his tweet. So he says something, you flag it. But last week, you know, they actually paused his account. It prevented him from being able to post. And when I said, you know, I asked the company, I said, well, what would have happened if a natural disaster occurred, a cyber attack, terror attack, earthquake? Would you have reactivated his account? What would have happened there? And just silence. You know, and then, of course, you know, yesterday, you know, we still don't know a lot of details about how these emails came to be or any of the details. But what's so fascinating to me is kind of this disconnect between, you know, when the quote unquote Trump dossier came out and, you know, you had the media just happily reporting, regurgitating that out there. no censorship. And what's interesting is yesterday, you know, Twitter initially said, well, this is material that was released without authorization, and so that's why we're not going to allow it to be out there. But then that raises the question, well, you know, when the New York Times used Trump's tax returns without authorization, that wasn't seen as a problem. What's interesting is kind of this dual standard. Because you think about it, investigative journalism, part of that is oftentimes relying on new material that was not voluntarily provided. And that's where so much of this comes from. And if you look at these policies on the surface, you know, Twitter initially said, well, it's because the material wasn't, you know, released. And then eventually under pressure, you know, they pointed to one of their policies that says the material may have been hacked and we don't allow hacked material to be reported. But their policy says news media is exempted. So then they had to clarify again and say, well, it's because there's a screenshot of one of the things in there. Then they had to clarify again as that got shot down and say, you know, you can, they didn't redact the email addresses. And so in the emails, you can see if they'd redacted the email addresses, you know, it might have been different. You know, again, it's that story just constantly changes. And Facebook, you know, their response is, well, because we don't know if it's real or not.
We're waiting for our fact checkers, yeah, to give us the high sign. I want to, when we come back, I want to get your reaction specifically to what Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey tweeted out regarding this controversy. More with Khalid Lataro, Real Clear Media Fellow and Senior Fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security right after this.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. We're speaking with Khalid Lataro, who is the Real Clear Media Fellow, Senior Fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. And Khalid, as we're talking about Twitter and Facebook's response to this New York Post story about Hunter Biden's alleged emails, Jack Dorsey tweeted out, "Our communication around our actions on the New York Post article was not great, and blocking URL sharing via tweet or DM with zero context as to why we're blocking, unacceptable." What does that tell you about Twitter's sensitivity to public opinion with respect to their censorship policies?
It's a fascinating one because most companies tend to provide sort of a unified front. First off, you have the spokespeople say something. Then if that doesn't qualify, the CEO gets up and reads from a script. You know, Twitter has always operated a little bit differently. Dorsey kind of operates from afar. If the public pressure gets too big, he kind of acts, you know, good cop, bad cop, coming in there and saying, gee, you know, they didn't do things right. And this seems to sort of fall into that general category of, you know, him publicly saying, boy, we did an unacceptable job here. But you'll notice there, he didn't change anything. He didn't say, we got this wrong, we're going to allow sharing again. His only comment was, we didn't explain ourselves well enough, but the rules still stand. We're still blocking sharing of this story.
You pose this question. I mean, these are just two good examples. Another one we talked about in this show, which you write about, is Yelp's new policy of identifying businesses that suborn racist behavior. I mean, talk about opening up a hornet's nest with that sort of thing. But they don't seem to care. I mean, this is, you know, all part of Yelp's new woke policy or whatever they're calling about. They're going to eradicate racism by amplifying everybody who has a complaint, regardless of the potential merit of that complaint. Jussie Smollett's going to have a field day. So the implications of policies like you're seeing play out with Facebook and Twitter on political content, policies that really impact people's business and professional lives, like the Yelp policy I just referenced, and, you know, what you see in terms of how that is going to comport with our civil society.
What's so specific about the Yelp policy, what really struck me was, you could say if they're relying on police reports, court reports, forensic analysis of video, et cetera, you could at least say there's evidence here. What's so fascinating about the Yelp policy is they say, for verification, they're going to rely on news reporting. If a news article says something, that's verification. That, to me, is this really striking thing, because this is that challenge that's coming in of, what is truth? As social media companies decide that, you know, we got to cut down on falsehood spreading around the web, what is truth? How do you decide that? And what was interesting is I talked to Facebook and I said, well, back in February, you had the government say, don't wear a mask. Now they're saying, wear a mask. You know, how do you decide what's truth? You know, someone had posted back in February, wear a mask. Would you have deleted that? And the answer I got back from Facebook was, these are really hard problems. And we hope that the government steps in and actually basically outlines these things so that we as a private company don't have to do that.
That's insane. And because what you're saying they're doing and what they're actually doing is deciding who are oracles of truth and who are not. They're not deciding on the merits. They're saying, if this is somebody I like because I like government agencies, then I'm going to take their word for it. If it's somebody I don't like because it's a conservative business owner, then I'm not going to take their word for it. That's what they're really doing.
What's interesting about this is when you get the truth, I mean, think of the Tara Reid case against Biden. Me too, we have to believe all the stories. Then one surfaces against Biden and it's silence. What's so interesting about this, take Facebook's new policy where they said, we're not letting this Biden story circulate because we're not sure if it's true yet. They haven't, to my knowledge, this is the first time they've actually done this, and the company has refused to comment whether they've ever done this before. Imagine a week from now, another Tara Reid shows up and says, Joe Biden assaulted me, you know, 20 years ago. That story under Facebook's new policy, Facebook is going to have to make a decision. Do they believe the story or not? And they're going to have to silence that person or allow that story to go. And this is a very dangerous place when you allow these private companies operating in this black box to decide, you know, what's true, what's not. And, you know, a First Amendment doesn't apply here. They alone decide. And, you know, the way I always summarize this is ask your nearest Alexa device, is Amazon a monopoly? It won't hesitate to say Amazon is not a monopoly. You know, and pretty soon that's what's going to happen when you post something online.
You know, it's interesting, too, on the Yelp thing, the whole idea of, oh, a news article is the all the verification we need. You could have a news article, some local blog and so forth that whether, you know, somebody made an allegation, somebody else responded that it's not true or put it in context. But as long as you have the flag on your business that some racist event occurred there, or alleged racist event occurred there, somebody said a crossword to somebody, it could have been patrons, it could have been staff and a patron, and you've got a news blurb about it, then you get that scarlet Yelp brand on your business. I mean, that could destroy your business. And, you know, I know there's legal remedies like for Yelp users who've slandered businesses saying things that were untrue. But I mean, you know, small business people can't afford to be litigating these matters all the time. This is really problematic.
The other issue, too, is again, it comes back to, you know, if you rely on a police report, then at least, you know, the person went to the police, they made an accusation, and at least then, you know, there's consequences for it. And there's at least some level of vetting there versus just you got some local newspaper to write about it. And, you know, I think it was University of Albany, I think, was the famous case where you had the group of women that boarded the bus and then reported that they had been attacked and led to this huge situation that eventually when the police got involved and went for surveillance video from the bus, it turns out that the story was very different and, you know, it all sort of imploded. And that's one of the challenges here is that the whole goal of media nowadays, unfortunately, is to be first, not to be right.
And also on this score, too, there's some things that are not objectionable that are not illegal. So in terms of your police report, so you can say a crossword, you can even say something that people would say is racist or intemperate in some way. What Yelp is doing now is saying, we're going to hold you responsible for the conduct of or the speech of someone else, even if it's not a crime, but it's a thought crime on your premises. I mean, you know, that is the definition of Orwellian.
Well, and that's what's interesting, too, is, you know, our legal system here, you know, was built because of what happened, you know, in Europe. This idea that laws could be constantly changed, that you could be, you know, put in jail. And there's still many countries in the world where you can be put in jail for thinking a bad thought against the government. But in this country, we, you know, our legal system was designed very carefully so that you can express what you feel. And, you know, what we're seeing here is Silicon Valley, you know, there are a lot of people that don't like that. They want to be able to enforce acceptable speech rules, enforce acceptable idea rules. And we can't do that under our legal system. So Silicon Valley is stepping into that void and setting it up so that even if the law says you can say whatever you want, if the mediums through which you do that, Twitter, Facebook, et cetera, if they block you from saying anything or publishing stories that they don't like, then, you know, it doesn't matter what the law says that you can or can't do. If you physically can't do it, it's the same thing. And that's just so powerful that a handful of companies now, and they're not just for the U.S., you know, China can censor people in China. It can't censor us here in the U.S. Facebook and Twitter censor the entire planet. And that's what's so frightening about this is they can just disappear something globally.
When we come back, I want to get to your take in the limited time we have on that documentary, The Social Dilemma, and if you think that would be the impetus for reform in big tech, or at least the prospectively reform in big tech. More with Khalid Latourl right after this.
Listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the show. We're speaking with Kalev Laturo, Real Clear Media Fellow, Senior Fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. He has written a good piece about big tech, social media's role in democracy, more harmful than helpful, question mark. I wanted to get your take on The Social Dilemma, this documentary that came out in the last few weeks that has gotten a lot of buzz, particularly among parents, thinking about screen time, thinking about the addictive nature of the social media platforms, and these sort of cast outs from and some self-exiled from the big tech companies, Facebook and Twitter and Google, gave, you know, real texture to some of what we already suspected to be true, knew to be true, but real texture and detail that I think expands the understanding of just how extensive it is, how big it is, how all-consuming it is. And so what is to be done about it? The question is, does the reform of big tech, to the extent that's possible, do you see that coming from inside Silicon Valley, inside big tech, from those individuals like the men and women who are profiled in that documentary?
I'm pessimistic that Silicon Valley can fix itself. You know, you think about it, these companies, their money machine essentially is firing us up. And so, you know, I can't really imagine a Silicon Valley that doesn't have suffered from all these issues, because we have to have a reason to go back. It's kind of like, why don't we have all these issues with LinkedIn? Well, because LinkedIn is where you go for business. You go there to actually to learn things, to network. It's these other platforms that we really seem to be having all these issues with. I don't see that can be reformed there.
Well, so then some of what else has been proposed, I mean, is it everything from tax policy to removing the indemnification for defamation suits? Did anything that you've heard, breaking them up? I mean, if you really want to get drastic antitrust policy, anything that you've heard that you think may have some promise to, if the goal is a more even-handedness?
See, I don't know that breaking them up is going to do anything, because I think this is not a necessarily a monopoly issue. It's more the fact that they're able to control speech. Even if you broke them up, they'd have that control of speech. To me, the answer really is transparency. You know, Twitter today can block all posts to the New York Post and not say a word about it. Just do it. A snap of a finger. They're never accountable to anyone. There'll never be a postmortem. Jack can say, hey, you know what? We didn't communicate well, but no harm, no foul. And so to me, what you really need is transparency. Like, if the public knew what these companies were doing, and if the companies had to be accountable, because right now the public's being told, hey, you know, guess what? We're doing all the censorship. We're doing all this stuff. But it's for your own good, and it's a good thing. Just trust us. And the public has nothing to question. If the public actually saw, here's what's really happening. Here's what they're blocking every day. Here's what they're, you know, they've decided is okay and not okay. It's like when The Guardian published Facebook's internal documents that said anti-Semitism is okay, you can do it. That provoked this huge backlash and forced the company to shift. When they published that violence against women was okay according to Facebook's rules, that prompted a pushback and they changed the rules. And so I think transparency is really the way to go, because it gets the public mobilized and the public can weigh in and say, guess what, this isn't acceptable, and push the politicians that otherwise are not going to break up something that makes money and, you know, helps them get reelected. It's the transparency, I think, is the way to go.
Kalev Laturo, Real Clear Media Fellow, Senior Fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. Kalev, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Take care.
This is the Dan Proft Show.